Nick, apparently you have a few friends because about 100 of you showed up just last Wednesday at the Statler for a job fair. So tell us, why were you there? What was going on?
So Cornell decided that it would be a good idea to bring a career fair to campus that featured Boeing and L3Harris. Boeing and L3Harris are both directly involved in the production of arms that have been used to carry out the ongoing genocide in Gaza, carried out by the Israeli military. I'm part of an organization called the Coalition for Mutual Liberation at Cornell. It's a coalition of over 40 organizations on campus. It includes political organizations, identity-based organizations, a couple dance groups and cultural organizations in there. And we've been fighting for divestment from the genocide in Gaza for just about a year now, since things really started going in October of last year. So part of divestment, you know, it obviously involves the university's endowment, but the other component of that is severing these corporate partnerships and the ties that our corporate universities have to arms manufacturers, to the companies that are directly involved in perpetuating a genocide. So students elected to disrupt that career fair. I didn't personally go in. I'm on disciplinary probation thanks to some actions last semester. But about 100, 150 of my peers entered the career fair with pots and pans, noisemakers, began chanting, and they were able to stay in the ballroom where it was being held at the Statler Hotel for about 30 minutes until Boeing and L3Harris had packed up and left.
That is fantastic. Congratulations. That's pretty amazing. Later, we'll get to some questions about last year. We're really right now, this is big. What you guys did is really big. Now, was this reported then by ABC, CBS, NBC, New York Times?
I think I understand where that question's coming from. No, of course not.
Yeah.
Got picked up by Democracy Now!, who can be counted on from time to time. But of course, no. I mean, these things are the talk of campus when you're passing through the coffee shops and libraries. It's what everyone's talking about. And you'll often see stories about Ivy League universities get picked up by the corporate press, but it always seems to be over, if you'll excuse it, some bullshit that doesn't have much to do with what students really care about. So, of course, these things don't always go too far, although our TikTok and our social media did get some traction. I think students around the country and young people around the country who feel strongly about Gaza are certainly paying attention, and I think that's something that matters.
You did get your video out on Snapchat and other, So that went to all the universities. Any contacts that responded? Do you think anybody is going to pick up on that? It's hard to say, isn't it?
No real comment, but I think it's a cool national movement. Everyone's always learning from one another, looking at what's working, what's not working, and having those conversations. So Boeing, L3Harris, and the 10 other arms manufacturers that we've demanded to divest from here at Cornell, they're recruiting at elite universities all around the country that saw encampments last year. They rely on these large endowment, powerful universities for their recruiting pool. And I think across the country, you've certainly seen students express strong dissent to what those companies do. So I would not be surprised if there was another one.
Staying on that point about the media, I think is important. Before I came and Wilton myself wanted to speak with you, I Googled to see what the New York Times had to say about the event. And of course, there was nothing there. They did have a report on September 3rd saying that things were pretty quiet on college campuses. And then this past Sunday, the Sunday New York Times, there was an article on a big, well-known individual who wrote that it's the end of the road for college activities, that it seems that because of administrative pushback this past semester, and especially over the summer, new rules and regulations, that it looks like they have won and that students have been crushed. And yet nothing was said that several days before this was printed, Cornell University, a major United States university, an Ivy League university, with over 100 students that shut down two major merchants of death. That's pretty powerful, and nothing there. So why is that, though? Why is it that the media does not report stuff like this?
I mean, I think the corporate media is acting part and parcel with the strategy of these universities, which is to cultivate a feeling of despair, that it's useless, that these universities are invulnerable to any kind of attack. I remember at Barnard College last semester, over 2% of the student body ended up being suspended due to the protests in Gaza. You know, the numbers of students that are speaking up about this on campus and the number of students that even tacitly are supportive of the protests and are encouraged by them. At Cornell, we had a referendum last semester through our student government over 50% of students showed out to vote on the question of divestment from arms manufacturers. And just about 70% of students voted yes on that question, despite really brutal pushback from the university and from other student organizations. So I think that power and the growing sentiment, that it's palpable if you're on these campuses, if you're a student here. I think you can feel it, even if you can't read about it in the pages of the New York Times, that there's something waking up within the student body. And so universities have to push that message. Oh, these suspensions and these arrests and the police brutality you've seen at universities like Emory and UCLA and Emerson, that's been effective. Because in truth, you know, it's been the opposite. The suspensions and arrests here at Cornell have only activated people further. I'm very active in my local music scene. It wasn't something that I mixed with my politics all too much, but after I got suspended, you know, I started getting all these questions from people I talk to every day on campus who considered themselves apolitical but attended this immensely powerful university asking, what's that about? How can I get involved? You know, what are these people doing? And so, yeah, I think the universities are imploding. They're sort of crumbling at their core, and they've got to mask that however they can with that propaganda.
And you guys are going to really stay on top of this by contacting other colleges and universities around the country with your videos and your comments and all. And what about the Cornell Sun? Have they written anything yet?
I will say the current Cornell Sun editorial board has been pretty solid. They regularly report on our actions. And I do think it's a reflection. It certainly wasn't always that way. This is my third year here at Cornell, and I've been involved in different forms of campus activism for some time. And for a while, there was certainly a hostile relationship between students who wanted to go on to careers in journalism and reporting and activist students who didn't receive the kind of coverage we would look for. But I think now there's a feeling not only that this is the story, but that this is a story where student protesters are on the right side of history, even if those in power haven't come around to that idea just yet. We always joke about the fact that we'll get our plaque in 40, 50 years. Maybe Cornell will pay for our alumni reunion. But as long as that hasn't happened yet, yeah, I think there are student journalists who have picked up on that. I would be remiss if I didn't shout out the Columbia radio engineers who were covering live during the police raid on their encampment in New York City. Really brave student journalists who were brutalized by police, who were locked in buildings and followed through, put themselves on the line to cover those stories. So they're not all great, but some of them, I'd say, are pretty remarkable.
Is there any piece from the Cornell Sun that has been written since last Wednesday?
Yes, there was a news write-up, and I also am an opinion columnist for the Sun, so I guess I should have acknowledged my bias earlier.
Sure. Okay, yeah. Well, no, it's good to get this to not just every Ivy League school, but everyone in the place. Let's go back for a minute to the action itself. How did that come about? I mean, there must have been some good planning involved without giving names or anything like that, but there must have been some very good planning before it developed.
I don't think there's a ton I can say on that front, but it certainly did look that way. And I think when students are so enraged about the corporate ties of their universities and those investments, there are a lot of lengths that people will go to when they're driven by that degree of emotion and objection to what their university is doing.
Right. Let's jump back to what you said last year you received some retribution from the university. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so like I said, I'm involved with the Coalition for Mutual Liberation, and I'm a member of YDSA at Cornell, the Young Democratic Socialists of America, which is one of the member organizations of that. In both of those capacities, I helped out with CML as sort of a visible press representative. And then there were a couple different building occupations over the course of the semester that then ultimately led to the encampment. And instances where CML was negotiating with Cornell administration, I was one of the people on the bargaining committee. So a couple days into the encampment, I had stepped out of the camp for a moment into a building to take an interview or something, and then I walked back out onto the quad, and I had a bunch of friends run up to me and say, check your email, check your email. And I saw it and noticed that I'd been temporarily suspended from the university. I was alongside four others then. There were six more suspensions that came down the pike pretty recently after that. But temporary suspensions, you know, one of the things I always like to emphasize is that these universities are not quite as organized as they would like to appear. They're throwing these processes and these terms and these disciplinary procedures together as they go along, because most of them are not used to brutalizing and to antagonizing student protests. It's not something they've been, I guess, put in a position where they're uncomfortable enough to do in some time. So temporary suspension is really designed for people who are engaged in acts of violence or sexual assault or those cases where a student is unsafe to be present on campus. So I was told I was no longer welcome in any of my classes. I wasn't to be on campus. I lived in student housing on that time, and I was given the pretty clear impression, it wasn't clarified otherwise, that I would be evicted from my dorm, which resulted in me for a time moving out on the assumption that that was something that would happen. But yeah, eventually that eviction got overturned after a coalition of faculty members, the Graduate Student Union, and a few other stakeholders on campus spoke out strongly against it. But yeah, the effect of that being de-enrolled from the university, it ended up only being for a few weeks. The university overturned it after classes had ended and students had gone back home for the summer. But I effectively lost that semester. The months and months of work that I had put in resulted in no credit. As a junior, I'm now retaking courses with sophomores, which I have some feelings about. But yeah, it's definitely been an inconvenience.
This is American heroic work that you're doing, and it may not be recognized by the institution, but the many organizations and the growing organizations of peace and justice developing in the country applaud you, Nick, and all of your friends. You are people. You're the people of the 60s, you know, the individuals who stood up when they saw the violence that was going on in Vietnam. And now with the horror, the genocide in Gaza, and on the cusp, really, of possible World War III, what do you think students will do in coming weeks? Do you see that they are going to support even more some sort of reaction to what is happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, thank you. That means a lot. And I think it's something that I try to emphasize and other people involved in this organizing try to emphasize is that, you know, it's easy to get caught up in one of the things on the earlier point. The corporate media really loves these individual stories about students who have experienced repression or students that have some personal tie, whatever that may be, that aren't actually about students engaging in effective organizing that challenges power. Every interview that I've given, and I got a lot of requests after the suspension came out, I've been asked, how do your parents feel about this? You know, these individualist questions that have nothing to do with the beliefs and values in organizing that have led me to get involved in this work in the first place. But yeah, the student movement right now, I think, is very powerfully aware of the fact that we are historical actors in this moment. I wish there was something other than the student movement that was a counterweight to our government's unconditional support for an ongoing genocide that's killed probably over 100,000 people by now, that's now turning into a wider war as Israel expands its assault on Lebanon and kills children and women in yet another country. You know, it would be excellent if there were a labor movement or other organizations that were up to the fight. But I think the reality right now is that the student movement is one of the movements that's most able to restrain our government in this time of just imperialist crisis and dispossession. And so I think that is how people understand ourselves. We get asked, why does repression not work? Why do the arrests and suspensions not seem to quell the movement? Which I don't think they do. I think they further activate it. And I think it's because people have a deeply founded belief that things like an educational future and a career path can wait in a time where people are under the most brutal conditions imaginable.
Yeah. Back in the 60s, you know, when those of us who protested the killing, which eventually amounted to millions of Vietnamese peasants and people, we were said to be anti-American and communist. Today, they're saying if you support the people of Gaza and Palestinians in general, you're anti-Semitic. How do you view that?
I mean, I'm maybe not the best person for the question because there are so many members of Jewish Voice for Peace and Jewish members of our coalition that have been not just supportive, not just signing off, but at the core of our organizing, doing a lot of the work. And really powerfully in the conversations that I've had with them, describing how their Judaism gives them a moral obligation to defend oppressed people around the world and to say, you know, not in their name. I think hearing those stories has been really powerful. My first introduction to pro-Palestine organizing was in 2021 during the siege of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and I was brought to downtown Chicago by two Jewish friends of mine. I think those traditions are deeply interwoven into this movement, even if it never receives coverage. And I think, frankly, the hyper-focus on these allegations that comes from the corporate media and that comes from these universities is sort of a paper tiger. It's a justification that's being used for the real motives, which are unspeakable. No one at this university is going to come out and say, I believe that Boeing and L3Harris have the right to bomb children in Gaza indiscriminately. I believe that Israel has the right to cause of famine and block food aid coming into civilian areas of Gaza. These are arguments that still, at least in the U.S., you sometimes hear Israeli pundits making these kinds of arguments, but in the States, you rarely do. But finding these other justifications that they can capitalize on, I think in bad faith, is really disgusting when you see things happen that way. Because anti-Semitism is real, and exists everywhere, including in the context of movements. But the allegations that come usually externally from parents, from donors, they make it harder to find the real cases of anti-Semitism that exist because it's a bad faith deployment of that that's really, I think, condescending and, yeah, does not take seriously the actual oppression that embodies what anti-Semitism is.
Another thing that's on my mind, though, too, Nick, is that besides L3Harris and Boeing, there were other war makers that were there as well. Did you get a list of all those companies? I don't expect you to, you know, to recite them right now, but there were others besides these two at that job fair, were there not?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, there are so many companies that have connections and attachments to the Israeli state that we can endeavor to engage in boycott and divestment actions.
But there were other companies at that event besides L3Harris and Boeing, is that right? Or was it just those two that...
It was a full career fair, yeah.
Full career fair.
With several tables, yeah.
Well, don't you feel kind of bad, though, that you messed up all those kids who were going in there to interview for jobs?
So, yeah, this is something I talk about a little bit in the editorial I wrote on the action for the Cornell Sun about... A lot of students had a similar reaction saying, well, don't students have the right to apply to work for arms manufacturers? You know, what if the only job a student can find is working for a company that assembles missiles that kill children? You know, don't you feel for those students? And I think the answer is no, I really don't. I think it's people's moral obligation to turn down those opportunities and to recognize that their actions have consequences. And to other students at the career fair, certainly I do feel, you know, for the students who are there applying for regular jobs in whatever industry it may be, although it was the labor school's HR-focused career fair event, and I'm one of the labor students, so I wasn't too disappointed in some of those cases. But for the other students, I think the purpose of actions like these is not only to directly confront companies like Boeing and L3Harris, it's also to make clear to the broader student body and the Cornell community that having these people around is a threat. When Boeing and L3Harris come to Gaza, or come to nations in the global south, it means death, it means destruction, it means devastation in civilian areas, it means the destruction of every university that was remaining in Gaza. When Boeing and L3Harris come to Cornell, they're welcomed. I imagine they have a nice meal at the Statler Hotel, and they can comfortably exist around other employers and other stakeholders in the university. I think there's a large contingent of students that don't think that should be the case, that they should be made to feel uncomfortable and that we should be uncomfortable when we're around those genocide profiteers.
I'm wondering, is there a possible case against Cornell University for aiding and abetting murderous companies to come and deal with their students?
You know, I find, I know various university groups have sued on the basis of discrimination against Palestinian students and their allies or found other legal grounds. But I think ultimately the task is going to fall to the people who are involved in institutions like Cornell, to the last human elements, I think, in a university that's rapidly looking more and more like a private equity firm or a hedge fund. It's going to have to be those people that prosecute the case, making in the court of public opinion the argument that our universities should not be genocide profiteers, that they should not be these $100 billion financial institutions necessarily, but that they should be places of learning and authentic education. And I think we can make the argument, and it's very easy to, looking back to the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s, where students were leaders, or back to the 60s in Vietnam, that universities can be moral leaders, and oftentimes they're the only institutions democratic enough and flexible enough that they can take those stands before, God knows, the private sector, and most often the government, does what's necessary to win something like an arms embargo and a lasting ceasefire. So yeah, I think it's going to fall to students and stakeholders and citizens to speak up and make that case for themselves.
I kind of wonder if the universities, the administrators, as well as the students who might even be opposed to them, if they're aware that these corporations are actually breaking U.S. law, and not just U.S. law, but not civil law, criminal law. It's criminal law that they're breaking. The Leahy law is just one example. Senator Leahy, retired now, but put into a law that you cannot, companies, corporations, cannot send weapons to a known human rights abuser. The whole world knows who is the number one human rights abuser today with genocide going on. Now, doesn't this somehow imply, and I'm not an attorney, but we have had attorneys who researched all this. Attorney Terry Lodge of Ohio, a nationally known attorney, Attorney Marjorie Cohn of San Diego Jefferson School of Law, They have researched these six laws, and you can go online at veteransforpeace.org and find the letter that some people have tried to deliver to these corporations. Maybe these letters should be available for the administrators. Should they know that they are aiding and abetting the breaking of law? Do you think that might be a possibility for your team?
You think it would be a strong argument. And at the career fair action, both Boeing and L3Harris protesters dropped off convictions, statements finding both companies guilty of profiting off a genocide that displayed some more evidence of what exactly these companies are involved in and the illegality of it, which you touched on. And I know it's been a major point. But I mean, ultimately, as long as we have a government, I think that fundamentally does not understand the people of Gaza, does not understand Palestinians or people across the global south to be people, to have rights and communities and lives worth protecting, they're never going to believe that laws like that apply to them. Maybe if missiles were being dropped on Cornell University, people would start talking about what it means to destroy a university or what it means to drive 1.9 million people from their homes. It's certainly far from the topic, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it yesterday, the suspension of our comrade Mamadou Tal, who's a graduate student here, a PhD candidate, and he's an international student as well. He was present at the Career Fair Action. He spoke and has historically been a visible advocate for our cause. He's got an international platform as someone who's very known and one of the most prominent Africana studies scholars at our university. And he was notified with 30 minutes of notice, no due process, without bargaining with his union, as Cornell had previously agreed to, that he was suspended from the university and that by tomorrow, the university would notify immigration services of their intent to deport him.
Seems like a violation of the First Amendment, doesn't it, by the university?
It certainly does. And it's a borrowing of tactics from the universities and the institutions here in the Imperial Core that are bankrolling genocide and dispossession around the globe. The saying goes that fascism is imperialism come home. And I think you're seeing the same rhetoric, the same tools being used against student protesters here to intimidate them into silence in a deeply racialized, violent, sickening manner, the weaponization of this really brutal immigration system against student organizers here in the States.
Yeah. At Binghamton University, which of course is just right down the road from Cornell, about an hour away, students have not been as proactive as the Cornell students, but nevertheless, they have disrupted two job fairs so far this semester. And in the first job fair, they blocked and then were moved away by police, blocked the entranceway to the job fair. And there was one individual who had a costume on as the Grim Reaper with a death mask and a black cloak. And his sign was directed toward General Dynamics, which probably, has been on this campus many times because Cornell's big into nuclear weapons, right? So General Dynamics then was giving out little atomic bomb symbols and also submarines to students, look like toys, like these were just fun kind of things. So what is your feeling about this kind of thing of allowing future General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin and all the rest in? Do you plan to continue your actions in future job fairs?
I think it reminds me of the university's immediate response to our action where they really stressed that this was violent, that there were some police officers that were hassled as people entered the building allegedly. People were making a lot of noise. The president of the university in his statement even said that by banging pots and pans, there was potential hearing damage committed to our peers. These are the kinds of things that the university cares about. And I think the way that they get away with that, to the degree anyone's buying this, which I think is very limited, it's pandering for donors and parents more so than the people who go here. But the reason they can make arguments like that is because they've achieved a normalization of the idea that you can go to Cornell for 4 years and you can work for an arms manufacturer, and that's normal. That's a justifiable decision to go get your money. You've earned it. You're a member of the ruling class, and you're welcome to go produce nuclear submarines for the rest of your life. And it's something that I think, to a degree, some of the student body has accepted, that that's something that's not within the bounds of criticism, for whatever reason it may be. And I think part of the reason that these kinds of disruptions are so powerful and so important is that they denormalize it. They remind people of the consequences of taking those kinds of positions and of how odd it is to be advertising a nuclear submarine at a campus, that it's actually deeply disgusting and frightening. And if you have peers sitting around you in your classes who intend to go produce weapons of war that'll be used to dismember infants in Gaza or around the world. That's something that should be disturbing to you. You can be someone who believes strongly in the humanity and the importance of standing up for Palestine in this moment and in advocating for those causes. You can also just be a person who looks at someone who's profiting off a genocide and sees nothing wrong with it and is deeply disturbed by that fact. These are creepy corporations that are profiting off some of the most disgusting actions in recent memory. They shouldn't be comfortable on our campuses. They shouldn't be welcome on our campuses. When our peers go off to work for them or even entertain the idea, we should be shutting them down immediately and shaming them for making that decision.
I'm wondering if you ever had any discussions about the possibility of going to some of those corporations that are located nearby. Just an hour's drive away will take you to BAE in Endicott, which is one of the major profiteering companies from the genocide in Gaza. BAE is the biggest factory or the biggest arms industry in all of Europe, and number 4 or 5 in the United States. That would be an interesting sort of show of you banging pots and pans out in front without the possibility of arrest unless somebody wanted to do that, right at BAE, just as I said, 55, 60 minutes away. If you go down a little bit further, Lockheed Martin makes the Paveway 1 and the Paveway 2 bombs that have been obliterating Gaza. And then just 10 minutes south of that, General Dynamics is making the 155 millimeter, the most wanted artillery piece or weapon by both the Ukrainians and the people of Gaza. Is there any possibility that you could take some actions along those lines?
Jack, that's an excellent question. I am not going to answer it on the record.
Okay. Well, think about it, okay? Think about it, and Veterans for Peace and Peace Action of New York State and Pax Christi would all be willing to support the students for any kind of action like that. I'd like to read something to you and see if you think it's maybe something that you could think about getting students to do. It's a pledge not to work for the arms industry, not to interview or to work for the arms industry. Basically what it says, this is a conscientious objection to interview or work for the war industry. I renounce and reject all allegiance to any firm that produces, sells, or gives weapons or weapon systems or hardware or software to any entity. I shall never interview for or accept any offer to work for any such firm. So we even have the QR code for it as well. Do you think you might be interested in getting that to students as a possibility?
Yeah, that's excellent. And I'd take it immediately. I think it's...
Well, you already took it then by saying that. Yeah. Yeah. But if you could consider, and I'll give you a copy of the QR code here as well, if you could get that out around the country from Cornell, doesn't have to say it's from Binghamton University. You guys just adopted it. It's not something that any particular group should lay claim to, because there is, of course, conscientious objection against the military. And we are in touch with the Conscientious Objection Center in Washington, D.C., who kind of think it's a good idea. So I'll send that to you via email too, okay, Nick?
Yeah.
What do you expect, for example, the Cornell administration and maybe other administrations, what do you expect them to be doing in coming weeks in retribution toward your call for free speech and for retaliation against genocide?
So the university has put out a statement via the president that they intend to engage in further suspensions of students and in pressing criminal charges against students who allegedly were involved in pressing past police officers and storming into the building is what they've stated. We'll see the degree to which that happened, and that statement was made a number of days ago, and so far it's only been one student, which I think tends to be their MO. Cornell understands that suspending 150 of their students would be chaos, would throw the university into a state of crisis, because despite the fact that this administration seems to believe that they can move about and make decisions as they want, students do actually have some power. We're the people who make this university what it is, and beyond just a bunch of parents becoming very upset very quickly, I think there's an impact that comes from that that would enrage the student body, that would enrage higher education nationally if they were to engage in that. So instead, they pluck off figureheads, people who they perceive to be leaders. In this case, it was our friend Mamadou, who was an especially visible face for the movement and just a really powerful advocate for our cause who's able to deliver the message of what we believe in so clearly. And then it's been other people who are involved in negotiation with the university or in speaking to the press or what have you. So I'm very skeptical of the idea that the university is actually going to go ahead and criminally charge all 150 people that were in that building that day. But they'll probably be more sly about it, more understated about how they try to undermine those students and peel them off from the majority. Although I don't believe it's something that will ever work to bring down the coalition. Or a little bit like a hydra, you know. After they cut off one head, 15 more people are even more enraged and willing to participate and organize and fill in those gaps. So repression only really serves to grow our movement when it happens.
Interesting, yeah. You know, you're a member of Gen Z, I guess, right? And there's been a lot of positive things said about Generation Z, including the great stuff coming out on the environment. Since the environment is so precious, so important, and that has been such a wonderful statement that in general that Gen Z has made to really begin to become more environmentally conscious. And also the whole business of gender, the great compassion that was not in previous generations, that now seems to be just totally accepted by Gen Z and to a large degree by other generations that you've taught. Do you think that maybe something is happening now that Gen Z is beginning to pick up on the war issue and that may become the next, or maybe it already is? What are your thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think every generation is shaped somewhat by the conditions that they grow up through. And for the millennials, I think the story that's become very popular is that they were sold the dream of things like owning a home and living in a future that was somewhat positive for them, of security, you know, some escape from this really precarious platform capitalism that we've got now. And that ended up being a sham. I think Gen Z, you know, we're children of the 08-09 recession, where we were never even given the promise that one day there would be security or stability or a world where it was easy or practical to prosper. We were just thrown into it. And I think it's largely a factor of corporate hubris. Since the 80s, the corporations and powerful people who rule our lives feeling that they can get away with anything, that there's no check on their ability to determine people's lives and to remove the sort of, I guess, cushioning that made it possible to exist under American capitalism for so long. So I think when you speak to members of Gen Z, I mean, I think there's a sense of political hope, to be certain, that's driving a lot of these protests. But if you ask enough questions about climate change or where they see the world in 15, 20 years, I think there's a sense that we haven't been left much and that the world is getting worse at an increased pace. So with that obviously comes some degree of despair, but also comes a degree of mobilization, of having very little to lose. So when it comes to a genocide going on in Gaza and universities that want to remove career opportunities or academic outcomes or all of these practical things, for a lot of students, I think they look at that and they say, you know, if we reach 2 degrees Celsius of warming in the next 5 years, what use is a degree anyway? That it's a moral prerogative to try and stop this machine before it eats us all alive. And that's actually the thing that's more practical to secure our future, or, you know, to protect the possibility of having a prosperous life going forward, is insisting upon putting an end to genocide, putting an end to ecological destruction, and to taking care of one another while we do it.
Yeah. The news out today is September 24th, and Netanyahu has ordered his forces, many of who are beginning to resist, I've heard. They're just tired. The Israeli soldiers have been beaten down in many ways that they're discouraged about what they're doing. They have some moral sense, some of them, that are saying, we're not going to do anymore. But yet the Israeli aircraft have been just bombing the daylights out of Lebanon. Lebanon doesn't have an air force, so it's a free action to go in and just pummel people. There are estimates now of over 700 people that have been killed. Will this event that's happening today, as we move, do you think this will energize Generation Z to begin to really stand up and say, push aside almost everything else? We know that the major factor is climate change, but here is a situation that is bordering on the end of it all with nuclear weapons, that there's a strong possibility with Israel having over 200 nuclear weapons that this could take place.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, something that has to be considered and that you're hearing more talk about, of Israel not only is a state that's carrying out an act of ethnic cleansing, but a state that's really been driven into a frenzy of self-destruction, of global destruction as they expand the front of these wars. It's very reminiscent of South Africa, you know, making incursions into neighboring states as their own state was collapsing. It's sort of a last gasp by, obviously, a political leader who's only still in office because he's trying to evade corruption allegations should he go out of office, and is prosecuting this war as a means of survival from a state that I think is suffering internal crisis and perhaps the beginnings of a collapse of the international support that's made it possible for them to prop up that settler colonial project for as long as they did. So I think certainly what's happening in Lebanon is deeply disturbing as both an incursion into possible expanded war, or at least a wider war in the Middle East, as well as the initial incursion of Israel sabotaging pagers that were being used, and in many cases killing children when these explosions went off. It's, I think, a terrorist attack in the truest sense, and it's the kind of action that destabilizes normal life, that makes security, that makes comfort, knowing that you are protected from violence, impossible, which is deeply concerning. I know people are paying attention, at least the folks that I talk to, and I think it's becoming more obvious that Israel is trying to protect themselves, and if they fall, take everyone else down with them. And that's disturbing to think about.
Being of the old generation, I just kind of wonder if the Gen Z students, and not just students, but all Gen Zers, are beginning to come to any sort of a realization that the country that they belong to, that they are members of, is operating in supporting genocidal acts and racial acts, right? Racism is involved. And of course, the total imperialistic control that the United States has with 800 bases around the world. Where do we differ from those who we malign, like the Russians and the Chinese? You know, what do you guys see as the difference between those cultures, the Chinese culture, the Russian culture, and what the United States seems to be doing?
Yeah, well, I'll take the first one first. I think it's important that you single out racial violence as an important component of that, because I would say the sort of initial awakening of a lot of young activists, I mean, there are a lot of places you can mark it, I would say, but the summer of 2020 and the expansion of Black Lives Matter protests, I think, deeply moved a lot of young people, and in many cases inserted them directly into the action that was occurring on streets and cities across the country. And I think that the memory of those actions and what that summer felt like to live through are deeply contested, and people in power have made a very concerted effort to post hoc define what we discovered about America, about young people, and about what was possible during that time. I think there was certainly an air of real revolutionary resistance to the state that did delegitimize it, with riot cops both being rolled out to cities and being directly confronted and often beaten. I think the image of the precinct in Minneapolis being burned to the ground will be seared into my memory forever. But I think it's the same case now of you're seeing both parties be equally complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And it's almost even more insincere coming from the Democrats, because it's couched in idea of that they're negotiating behind the scenes for a ceasefire, or that they really do care about the life of Palestinians. They even say the name Palestine, you know, from time to time. And that's supposed to persuade people that there's a real process to resolve this thing happening on their part. It's not. And I think the reason that young people can be so sincere in their convictions of that does have something to do with the way that information flow has changed. If you read the corporate media, you may come away with the understanding that there's a war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas, where Israel maybe has harmed some civilians, but ultimately is trying to put an end to terror attacks. But if you're watching videos that are being produced directly by Palestinian journalists, or just Palestinian civilians who have cell phones and are able to record the horrific things happening in front of them, those videos end up in the hands of young Americans who are horrified and are seeing a direct dissonance between what they're reading about in the press and what they're hearing from these institutions and from the government about what's happening in Israel and what's happening in reality. I think that's part of why, you know, the U.S. government seems to be so intent on banning TikTok lately, is these forums of information flow actually can be very dangerous if they're leveraged the right way. whether it's facilitating communication between Palestinians and people here in the States who support their cause, or whether it's online communication across the country between pro-Palestine activists who are coordinating our strategies, I think, discussing how to win this thing effectively and doing in-the-moment national coordination on a scale that we really haven't seen in these sort of historical anti-war movements that had to rely on other means to communicate with one another.
Do you think that there's some way that the United States could end this war pretty quickly?
Yes, an arms embargo, which I think is immediately obvious to anyone who's thought about the question for some time. And it's the lurking factor behind all of these faux statements coming out of the Democrats and other liberals in public places, as they say. I feel like there's a headline in the New York Times every week that comes out that says, okay, this time they're really playing hardball. They're insistent upon a deal. They're going back to the table with a new attitude. And then, of course, it always amounts to nothing. But the thing that looms so large in these negotiations is that America is almost solely responsible for arming the Israeli military and for selling the weapons that are being used to carry out the genocide. Very basic stuff. And when you hear about the role of the Palestinians in these negotiations, of course, they're not going to be participating in a manner that's reflective of sort of a neutral mediation space, when usually the party that's facilitating these negotiations is the party that's propping up one of the states and actively involved in the subjugation and the ethnic cleansing of the other state. I think it's quite clear. And so direct action against arms manufacturers and protesting their source of their capital, you know, that they used to be able to produce at scale these kinds of weapons, which is housed in private equity firms and is housed in university endowments. It's at the core of our work, and agitating for an arms embargo, I think, is the most important thing in this moment for activists to be thinking about.
You know, there's some who say that Israel is the tail wagging the American dog. Little Israel, who seems to be able to pretty much control the United States Congress. Ralph Nader has said that Netanyahu runs the U.S. Congress. And of course, he went to Congress, didn't he, not too long ago, and there were standing ovations for a man who most students, I would say, is a mass murderer. What can we do to lessen the power of the Israelis? What is your attitude and students with the leading lobby group called AIPAC? What do you see them as as any kind of a danger to United States democracy?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earlier that anti-war protesters historically, including currently pro-Palestine protesters, have been labeled as anti-American. I actually think it is pretty American to insist that our elections aren't bought and sold by another nation, that our politicians don't do the same, and that we're not spending, you know, billions of dollars supporting an army that's not defending our interests, that's carrying out a genocide that most Americans disagree with. I think all of those things are pretty essential tenets of American democracy. You saw just recently with the election in the Bronx of Jamal Bowman, where he was defeated by the most spending, I think, in a congressional race in history. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting about that race that doesn't always get talked about is that AIPAC was, by and large, the largest funder of money being spent against Jamal Bowman in that district. But the advertisements that were being produced with that money were never about Israel. They were about his vote on the infrastructure bill. They were about things that had been focus grouped and tested to make Jamal Bowman look bad in that race. But the reason that they weren't about Israel, which is this political action committee's only exclusive issue, because they know that it's deeply unpopular. They know that it's not just young people. It's anyone who takes the time to really investigate this thing. We'll sit down and within 15 minutes understand that this is an instance of occupation, that it's a case of genocide, and that Israel is not doing the things that it publicly states that it's doing in Gaza. It's so often said that, you know, this is a complicated issue. I really disagree with that notion. I think it's a very simple one. It's one of the more black and white issues we have to deal with. Genocide is something to be opposed at every turn, in every form, and this fits the bill.
Of course, the senator from New York State, Mr. Schumer, is also the majority leader of the United States Senate. The Senate is, of course, the agency that does foreign affairs, right? That foreign affairs is their job. He's also, by the way, the man who was selected by the Zionists when the Zionists had their huge gathering, not as big as they had hoped for, last winter in Washington, D.C. It was Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, who was the lead speaker. Now, his co-senator, Gillibrand, takes more money from AIPAC than almost anyone except Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer is the biggest a taker of lobbying money than any other senator in the United States. So what do you think about that? There's a race this year, for example, not a race. Kirsten Gillibrand is running against a woman by the name of Diane Sayre. Did you ever hear of Diane Sayre? Probably not, right? No, because Diane Sayre doesn't have the backing of the Democrat Party. She's an independent. And whereas Gillibrand, of course, runs on money that originated from BAE. BAE got her started here some 15 years ago by contributing to her campaign. So the question, I guess, is how can it possibly, can we control groups like AIPAC, the power that they have? Is there any way that Gen Z can stand up to AIPAC and begin to change?
Yeah, I mean, someone still has to be voting for these people at the end of the day. And I think that's becoming increasingly apparent. There's this dynamic, I think, between young voters, especially those who are left-wing in the Democratic Party lately, where people will sort of say that young people have a moral obligation to vote for the Democrats, whether it's harm reduction or whether it's other issues that the Democrats are marginally better on. And I think this is a really novel way of thinking about politics, where voters owe something to politicians and not vice versa. I think you're looking at a case, regardless of how people feel about what the strategic vote in the upcoming election is, I think there are fair arguments either way about what puts us in the best position to win the kind of demands that we want to see. But ultimately, the case is that the Democrats are losing their base, and they're losing the young people that careened them to victory in the 2018 midterms and these really close races, you know, where it's come down to margins, the young voters that have made that difference. And so we're approaching the 2020 election. It's looking tight. And I think on a national scale and on a state scale, the Democrats are going to learn one way or another that they can't simply disrespect the young component of their base.
Just one last question. What can we, the generations outside of Gen Z, individuals who are not in universities, what can we do to support you?
If you're in a community that has a university within it, certainly, at least from my experience, my background, it's community supporters that have often been essential. On the second day of our encampment, we were notified last semester that the local police department intended to arrest all of us who were present during the camp. And so we sent out a message over social media and through our various channels. In about an hour, we had assembled a crowd of about 300 people. And it wasn't just Cornell students. It was Ithaca College students. It was faculty, it was members of the community around us, just people in Ithaca who cared about the issue and recognized that the student movement had some power here. And thanks to those people who turned out largely from the community, we were able to prevent any arrests from taking place that night or for the rest of the encampment through that show of power. And so certainly as a student organizer, that's something that I think is important. Otherwise, I mean, every community I think now has some form of a pro-Palestine movement. If you're in a metropolitan area, there are people who are near you and who are organized around this cause. And so to the best of your ability, I would say, seek those people out and see what they need.
That's great. And keep us posted, too. And we'd like to come back and speak to you again as the days and the weeks develop here to see where you are at and what the latest is from the administration of Cornell University. Thanks, Nick. And once again, congratulations on a great effort shutting down the two big bad boys, L3 Harris and Boeing. You know, it was really an achievement that should be front page, the New York Times. You should be interviewed by NBC, CBS, the public radio, you know, and maybe someday you will. I think you will be because you're on to something. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate that.